Welcome to another episode of the Deborah Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. The conversation continues with cardiac electrophysiologist Dr. Rafael Corbisiero about AFib and how his team diagnoses it, stages it, and treats it, including an assessment of COVID's impact and new technologies in electrophysiology. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. We pick up our conversation with Deborah cardiac electrophysiologist Dr. Rafael Corbisiero about treating the most common arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation. If you or a loved one has been diagnosed with AFib, this will give you a very thorough overview of your treatment options.
The treatment for atrial fibrillation can be categorized. You can be kind of conservative, you could be middle of the road, or you could be aggressive with your treatment.
And what dictates that?
I think that's a combination of the doctor-patient relationship and what needs to be done. From my standpoint, when patients get to me as an electrophysiologist, I'm usually going to be more aggressive. That's what my referral has sent me. That's the patient has agreed to talk about more aggressive options as opposed to being conservative.
All right, so the conservative options are?
Usually it would be observation. Usually the most conservative thing is you may use some medication just to control the heart rate. In other words, when you have a paroxysm of AFib, you may give a little bit of medication so that you don't go as fast. And then you have to be risk stratified to see whether or not you need to be protected from stroke, you know, from clot formation. Usually the more conservative is to see whether or not they need a blood thinner.
Now, for somebody who had no idea this was going on, it's found on an EKG in another setting for another procedure, what kind of monitoring do they then need to be doing?
Those are the somewhat more difficult patients if they don't know about it. So those are the patients that we try to recommend a good monitoring strategy. If they're the kind of patient that will monitor themselves, then we'll ask them to do that. The cardia device is excellent. They can put on their phone and test themselves every now and then. The Apple Watch has an AFib monitor, which is very good. If the patient doesn't really want to do that, then we offer them what's called the loop recorder, a little device placed under the skin of the chest, and we just monitor them. Because we want to know whether they're having AFib, because we'll want to risk stratify the patient, right? There's a difference between a 55-year-old having AFib and a 95-year-old having AFib, and so you want to gear it towards that. My prejudice, usually in younger patients, is try to keep their heart in normal rhythm as long as possible, just, you know, in case anything else happens down the road.
When you say the loop recorder, you know, the self-monitoring, because you'll be checking your own watch when a loop recorder is involved, is that data going to the doctor then?
Yes. That's part of the remote monitoring strategy that we can follow patients 24/7.
How do you notice that something's off, and what action then is taken?
So we will get reports. So anybody with these days, any device, including a loop recorder, there's remote monitoring where the transmissions get sent to us to our remote monitoring clinic, and we'll see if a patient has episodes. The big thing about the episodes is if they last permanently. So if they last more than 24 hours, we're going to call that patient in and have a discussion. The way remote monitoring is set up is usually there's green, yellow, and red alerts. A yellow or a red alert, meaning something's abnormal, the remote clinic will call the patient to see what's going on. So if they have a permanent AFib and their heart rate's 200 and we call them and they say they're not feeling well, they're going to the emergency room. It's not perfect. You know, sometimes it takes 24, 48 hours for us to get the information and relay it to the patient.
It's not instantaneous.
Right. We don't have a satellite knowing when you're crossing the street and when it happened. And, you know, we're not going to call you like 5 minutes later.
There is the monitoring and the pharmaceutical to get the rate down. Is there a middle ground there or before they come to see you for the most aggressive?
The initial thought process when you have atrial fibrillation is what strategy you're going to take. So there's called the simple medication to control rate. So it doesn't prevent the atrial fibrillation from happening, but when it happens, you may not go as fast, as opposed to the rhythm control. That's when you're trying to maintain sinus rhythm. In that regard, there are two approaches to maintaining sinus rhythm. You can use medications called antiarrhythmics, which are meant to suppress the atrial fibrillation, keep your normal rhythm, versus a procedure called an ablation to try to treat the source of atrial fibrillation and prevent it from happening. Both have their pluses and minuses. Antiarrhythmic drugs are a pill that you take. but they carry lots of consequences, need to be monitored very closely. In rare instances, they actually can cause life-threatening rhythm problems. So they have to be followed very closely. And there's sometimes interactions with other things that are going on with the patient that may not work. The ablation is a procedure. So the risk with that is upfront. And that's what you kind of have to decide. In this day and age, with the recent data that's come out, I, as well as many people, believe that the ablation is superior to the medications. Usually we have this debate with physicians. However, I always remind them, when the patients figure out what's better, we should start to listen. Okay, so this recent study that was out called the Cabana trial, where the patients figured out that the ablation was better because there was such a huge crossover because patients didn't want the drugs, they wanted the ablation. And we've seen this in the past. You know, so I always say, when patients figure it out, we should probably listen.
The ablation situation has also changed a bit recently. Mm-hmm. So explain ablation, what that involves today for a patient that goes that route.
Okay. Ablation is a term meaning to sort of get rid of a problem, to ablate. So it turns out that in 1998 in France, they observed the initiation of atrial fibrillation. So it comes from the top left part of the heart, the left atrium, specifically from the veins of the lung as they plug in. Turns out that the way we're built, there are abnormal sleeves of tissue in the pulmonary veins that if they become active, that's what initiates the atrial fibrillation about 90-95% of the time. If it escapes the vein and hits the top part of the heart, it knocks the normal control, the sinus node, out of control and sends the whole top part of the heart into atrial fibrillation.
Now we're talking about electrical impulses.
Correct. So what they formulated back in 1998, Michelle Hassegara said that if we could prevent those atrial fibrillation signals from getting out of the vein, we could do a good job of controlling normal rhythm. So the ablation is basically laying down an electrical fence that surrounds the pulmonary veins that does not allow the electrical signal to cross. The procedure is done as a procedure. It's not surgery. Typically, the patient's asleep. We enter the vein of the leg. We go up into the heart, get to the top part of the heart. We cross over with something called a transseptal maneuver to the top left part of the heart. And there, the ablation wire, the tip of it, is able to generate heat. This is for the radio frequency ablation. And basically, we're not damaging the heart. We're basically cauterizing around the veins to dry out those cells so that electrical signals cannot cross. We make that fence good enough, then we have a great chance of preventing the AFib from happening.
And basically ending it.
So ablations are not perfect.
Right.
The chance of success in a structurally normal heart, patient with very few risk factors and who is paroxysmal, usually we'll quote 75-80% chance that we'll get it the first time, knowing that there may be touch-up ablations in the future. The average number of ablations for patients once we go down the road of rhythm control is 3. So we may do the big ablation and then we may need to touch it up in the future. But then the success rate sort of climbs to 90%. So it is good.
And these people would then be off pharmaceuticals and just kind of on a monitoring plan?
It depends. The goal of the ablation is obviously to be able to stop any rate control drugs or any rhythm control drugs, if that's what they're on it for. So we get them off the drugs. The risk of stroke, we always have to assess. Nowadays, in your point with monitoring, we're monitoring patients so closely that if they maintain normal rhythm, even if they have risk factors, we may be able to hold the blood thinner. There's a good study out of Stanford that had patients with loop recorders monitored 24/7. They have no AFib, they don't need their blood thinner. But if they do have an episode, I think they said if it was more than 6 hours, the patient was notified and they restarted their blood thinner. So rhythm treatment with the ablation, yes. The risk factor for stroke is what we have to continually assess. The procedure is done from the vein of the leg. The reports out about ablation times, you know, usually when you read it online, oh, it takes 6 hours. It doesn't take 6 hours to do an ablation anymore. So you're in the room, the patient gets prepped. Usually our ablation times, we're running about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes. I do my ablations robotically. So I enter the wire into the heart, and instead of me manipulating a stiff wire by hand, trying to get it to go where I want it to go, I have two huge magnets that come into the patient on their sides, and I go to a computer. And the magnet actually steers the tip of the wire anywhere I want to go. there are two benefits to that. It's much safer because the wire, the way that the engineers built it, is it's extremely flimsy. So even if I point it right at the heart and tell it to go right at it, it just folds. Now, the good part about that is we're working on a beating heart, right? So if we have a nice flimsy wire and we place it where we want, it stays right where I put it. It doesn't bounce. So I think my ablations are a little bit better and safer. I do that usually within an hour. Nowadays, when we take everything out of the vein, there are devices to help close the vein. So bed rest is only for about 2 hours. Most of our procedures, patients are going home the same day. And then how they recover, for the most part, really has little to do with the ablation and more to do with how they do with the anesthesia. So most of our cases are done with conscious sedation, usually with propofol, which is well tolerated. So I've had patients, you know, get done on a Friday, back to work on Monday.
And the incision is probably the biggest concern.
It's just an intravenous, just like you would get in the arm.
So they're not going to do some weightlifting, you know, right away.
Yeah, you would use common sense, but
exactly.
At least it's not an artery where if that were to bleed, that would be a huge issue.
Mm-hmm.
Are there issues that happen with the vein? Sure, you can have issues, you know, with bleeding and swelling and whatnot. But the closure devices for the veins have helped that a lot.
For a symptomatic patient with AFib, somebody who was very sensitive to how it felt, and is that going to be settled down immediately then?
Depends on the patient, but yes, they should feel better.
It's not a question like you have to heal from the ablation for a few days and that'll settle down gradually.
Yes, you do have to, yeah. When patients become accustomed to what's going on with their rhythm and then you take it away, I call it, they sometimes have phantom symptoms. In other words, they think something's going to happen. And they wait for it and it doesn't come. That usually takes a while to heal. So the patient feeling better, it is a process. And the ablation, the typical radiofrequency ablation, we give 3 months for the ablation to kind of scar in or heal in. And then the patient should feel better. They become much more aware. A lot of times what they feel at least doesn't turn out to be anything. And that'll get better with time.
So are the devices changing, the technology changing? I've been reading about pulsed field ablation. So what's happening in this field?
There's different ways to perform an ablation. Radio frequency is an energy that's delivered through the catheter that damages the cells, dries them out. But there may be some sequelae to that. Rare complications that we can have with ablation is while you're ablating, you may actually damage the nerve that runs on the side of the heart where we may be running, called the phrenic nerve. If we damage that, then the patient has trouble with their breathing muscle. So make them short of breath. That's one of those extra cardiac complications that we worry about. The other one that was big in the beginning of ablations was if you burned too much, you would actually burn the atria to the esophagus, the food pipe, and that fistula, a connection between the food pipe and the heart, obviously is a life-threatening issue. Those are the two big things that we have concerned with when we started ablations with radiofrequency. They happen much less now because we're aware of them. Other modalities that have come and gone, there's a balloon that freezes the veins called cryo. I'm not a big fan of that, but studies have been done with that where they enter a balloon into the vein and then freeze around the vein. And that's the way they try to prevent the AFib from happening.
So instead of heat, it was cold.
It was cold, right. In fact, there was a big study called Fire and Ice that showed that both were sort of acceptable ways to start the treatment of rhythm control with ablation. The new one out is pulse field array, which is sort of a directed energy right at the cells without damaging anything else. I kind of call it like the neutron bomb, you know, it just takes out the people, all the structures are involved. That is new, and it's not that I'm skeptical, but I'm not sure it's the whole answer. There's issues with that I think we have to take a look at. It's a much more expensive procedure. There's much more anesthesia involved. There are non-cardiac sequelae that happen. There's reports that there may be more strokes with this, and it hasn't been shown to be superior. At best, it's shown to be the same as radiofrequency. So I'm not on the bus yet. I do think that the future is going to be a catheter that is able to deliver both radiofrequency and pulse field array, and it'll be anatomically determined where we're going to place which lesion. That's what I think the future is going to be. I think the other part of the treatment for atrial fibrillation is AFib is always a two-part treatment, right? We treat the rhythm problem. I think ablation is making tremendous success. I should think as a whole, we've gotten much, much better at it. And clearly, it is better than the drugs. In terms of the thromboembolic risk, the risk of stroke and clot, I think that the area that's involved in the heart, the appendage, we can now close the appendage from a procedure, same approach as the ablation, which gets the patient off the blood thinner. Blood thinners carry the risk of bleeding. So in the future, I think we're going to be seeing more and more what's called atrial appendage closure devices. This is the Watchman, the Amulet by Abbott. We can easily close this. Some people are actually thinking about doing both at the same time, the ablation and the closure device. But that would get the patient off the blood thinner, because blood thinner does carry risk of bleeding, plus the newer agents that are out tend to be very expensive. As always, Europe's ahead of us in everything. They've been doing it. The issues are, it does complicate the procedures, increases length of time, so that puts a risk to the patient. Plus, it is two different procedures with two different sets of equipment. But in high-risk patients who you don't want to go in, you know, more than once or whatever the reason might be, this is something that can be done. It has been done.
That's Deborah Cardiac Electrophysiologist Dr. Rafael Corbiziero. Join us next month for another detailed look at a health issue you or someone you care about may be facing, and information that can help you decide how to deal with it. As always, it drops the first Wednesday of the month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.